Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, all right. It is Monday. It's 12 o'clock, and this is What Doesn't Kill You. Food Industry Insights. My name is Katie Kiefer. I'm your host, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. A listener, supporter, non-commercial station. People, hit the donate button. Okay. All right. Let's start off with joys and sorrows. We have a really cool show today. Many of you may remember about a year or no, I've been following the story for almost 2 years. Bill Stowe, the CEO of the Des Moines Water Works, will be joining me later today to talk about Iowa State Supreme Court case he just lost, two, his pending federal case, and three, the attempted coup d'etat of the state of Iowa to basically dissolve the Des Moines Water Works so that they don't have to listen to his sorry ass anymore. I guess that's the point. But anyway, he'll be up in just a few minutes. In the meantime, it's joys and sorrows. So I collect these all week. So, and by the way, send in your own. If you want to go on my show page or you want to go on my Facebook page for What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights, please do. And, you know, tell me what your joys and sorrows are. I'd love to include some from my listeners. So just a reminder that I have those outlets. Here's my first one. Coal County Republicans, or rather Coal Country Republicans, that would be Kentucky, you know, Oklahoma, et cetera, West Virginia. Coal Country Republicans set to cut mine safety regulations. This was in the Huffington Post about a week ago. A bill approved by Kentucky lawmakers on Tuesday would cut back the number of state inspections of coal mines per year, and it would allow the state's Department of Natural Resources to substitute some of those safety inspections with what's known as safety analyses. Conveniently for the coal operators, those analyses do not pose the threat of citations or fines. Quote, if anything, federal policing of the coal industry will probably be scaled back under the Trump administration because President Donald Trump and congressional Republicans have been peeling back all manner of regulations on businesses, including the coal companies. And remember, Trump's new Commerce Secretary, billionaire investor Wilbur Ross, owned the Sago mine in West Virginia in 2006, where an explosion there cost the lives of 12 miners. And although the White House has not yet installed a new head of mine safety, Trump had complained on the campaign trail that mining regulations were way too tough. Coal operators could barely survive, he lamented. I have friends that own the mines, he said at a campaign event in Pennsylvania. I mean, they can't live. Cry me a frickin' river, okay? I hate these people. You know, I mean, I live in a state of like, I'm, and I know I'm not alone, of just like heightened exasperation. I mean, there's no wonder that my own waterworks are constantly erupting. Okay, that was in the Huffington Post, by the way, on March 15th, if you want to read more about it. Also, I would like to point out that the only adult in the room appears to be Secretary of Defense James Mattis. And who would ever have thought that someone whose nickname is Mad Dog might actually be tr- trustworthy. He has broken with the rest of the clown show and has acknowledged that not only is climate change real, but it's actually a threat to our national security. Go figure. So maybe we actually do need a military coup. What do you say, folks? Okay. And then I wanted to remind you that if you didn't send your postcards on the Ides of March, like, remember we were all supposed to like write a lot of postcards to Trump, to McConnell, to Ryan, complaining about all the things that we hate about what they're doing. I actually will tell you, I did write my postcards. I read about 20 of them. But I think I'm going to keep it up. I'm going to keep doing it pretty much every day. Those little 34-cent postcards that are already stamped that you can buy at the post office, they're great. And you just keep a little stack of them. And whenever something in the news hits your eye and you think, I won't stand for that, then you just write yourself a postcard. And the cool thing about them is that you don't have any obligation to identify yourself. So you can really get kind of wacky on them. And I know I have. I've been waxing quite biblical, as a matter of fact. And I find words like shame and infamy or figure large and block letters on my postcards. It's really kind of fun. It's very apocalyptic and cathartic. And especially when you're writing to that unspeakable hypocrite, Paul Ryan, who purports to be a Christian. I'm not a fan of organized religion, but anyway, you know, if you call yourself a Christian, presumably you have studied some of the Christian values. He doesn't appear to include those in his version of Christianity, but I really like to let him know, and I send these to his home, so maybe his wife and kids will read them, that he and his family will burn both on earth and in hell for denying climate change. So that's do your thing. Okay, here's another really gross story. Brazilian beef. We did not import Brazilian beef for about 13 or 14 years because they had hoof and mouth disease. But last year, we lifted our ban on Brazilian beef. And God knows, you know, here's what happens. You lift the ban and by God, they start shipping you rotten meat. So remember when Cool was repealed, the country of origin labeling? I mean, most of us really liked that law. But it was repealed because our trading partners, Canada and Mexico, were going to sue us for some, I don't know, I think it was $13 billion in fines, something like that. Anyway, just so you know, JBS and BRF, which is Brazil Foods, JBS is Swift and something else that combined a few years ago. In any case, they are the two biggest players in Brazil, and they were shipping out literally millions of pounds of rotten ground beef because they can. They were bribing inspectors to just, you know, look the other way when that was happening. So what they were doing was mixing up, in order to mask the smell of rotting meat, they would mix in some sorts of chemicals, or they would mix fresh product with rotting product. And of course, they were also adding weight by adulterating them with water and manioc flour. So I really should do a few shows on food fraud, I think, because it's a $40 billion international business. And people are, I mean, it just doesn't get covered enough. I mean, this came from a trade magazine. This did not come from mainstream media. So, I mean, lucky for us, we're not China and Russia who import literally billions of pounds of beef from Brazil. But still, get your beef ground by your butcher. You know what I mean? Like, buy it from a reputable source. It just makes me sick. Okay, now here's the good news for today. Here's the joy. It turns out that those of you who thought that cheese was really crack were right. The LA Times reported that the U.S. National Library of Medicine studied foods that generate addictive behavior in subjects in about 500 people, and cheese came in very high on that list. Why? Because the protein casein contains casomorphins, and casomorphins make your dopamine receptors dance, and that makes cheese addictive. So I can't help myself. I mean, I am a cheese addict. I like to call myself a cheeseaholic. You could be addicted to worse things, I suppose, than cheese. But I'm wearing a lot of it right now. And I'll probably have a heart attack because I do have high cholesterol. Anyway, that's it for Joys and Sorrows today. We're going to take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back with Bill Stowe from the Des Moines Waterworks, and we'll learn about what's going on there in great detail, and I'm looking forward to it. So stay tuned.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. One of the nice things about Bob's Red Mill is it's the only that I know of national supplier that's easily available for lots of interesting, hard-to-get grains and other seed products. So, you know, before Bob's Red Mill became widely available, you couldn't go get something like quinoa very easily, or you couldn't go get spelt easily in small quantities. But now you go to any one of the huge number of stores that carry Bob's Red Mill, and you can get smaller amounts of these really interesting, fun things to play with. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
And I'm proud to be sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, one of my favorite companies for sure. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My guest today is Bill Stowe, the CEO and general manager of the Des Moines Water Works. It is a regional utility that protects public health and promotes economic development by delivering outstanding quality water affordably in reliable quantities, which is what you want a water works to do. The Des Moines Water Works works closely with businesses, environmental, consumer, and agricultural leaders to advocate for better stewardship of water resources and clean water initiatives throughout central Iowa. Mr. Stowe sits on the board of directors of the Association of the Metropolitan Water Agencies, representing the largest drinking water utilities in North America, and he is a member of the American Society of Civil Engineers and a member of the Iowa Bar Association. So way to make the rest of us feel bad, Mr. Multi-Degree. Welcome back to the show.
Katie, you're too kind. You're too kind.
Not
sorry
at
for
all.
That puffery.
I love
but,
the puffery.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
Well, it makes me look good. If I have guests like you on, it makes me look like I'm smarter. So there you go. You have been a very naughty boy, apparently.
Well, apparently, gosh, yeah. We've had a kind of a rough 60 days here, and the nightmare quite hasn't ended yet.
Not
so
quite.
We'll keep fighting through it.
Well, we have an attempted coup d'etat on our hands, but we're going to get to that in a minute. I want you to recap for listeners what has been going on in the Des Moines Water Works for the last 2 years, and then what happened in January when the Supreme Court ruling came down on your case. What was that all about?
You know, essentially in the last several years, we have continued to see nitrate concentrations and agrotoxin pollutant coming down our rivers in extraordinary concentrations in a way that caused us a couple years ago to warn folks upriver that we would file a lawsuit in the event that they didn't better control what's coming through drainage systems under ag fields into mm-hmm. the Raccoon and Des Moines rivers. They ignored that. We filed a lawsuit. A portion of the lawsuit had both state and federal claims. The state Supreme Court dismissed out our state claims, and unfortunately the federal court late Friday also dismissed out our claims.
No.
And if that weren't enough, the Iowa legislature with a new Republican majority in both houses of the Senate and the state house, as well as the governor, have taken an opportunity to, under state law, essentially disband the Des Moines Water Works, which is right. an independent entity under state law, and move our assets and our governance under the city government. So there you go.
Holy smokes, Owen. I was not aware of the development on Friday. I actually should have checked in with your assistant, Lauren, about that, because I would have altered my questions, like, but no big deal. But let's pick this apart, because your suit, I'm reading from the newspapers around in January around the Supreme Court ruling, your suit requested damages from three upriver counties. But, and I'm going to quote here, paying damages would have been an enormous burden that I don't know we could have financially survived, said Colin McCullough, a drainage district attorney for Sac County, Des Moines. And that was in the Des Moines Register on the 28th of January. So what does he mean by that? Like, what does he say? We wouldn't have survived the damages. Who would pay them? Who would have been paying them? Would it have been individual farming entities?
The producers would end up paying it, I think, is his mm-hmm. point. And, you know, from our vantage, sustainable agriculture necessarily involves being responsible for the costs of production. So that, to us, is a huge misfire. It certainly has its own kind of red meat attraction to folks who think that we're trying to break agriculture somehow. But one of the themes of our litigation and our continued discussion about public policy as it relates to ag subsidies in particular mm-hmm. is that corn, soybean, and CAFO production creates externalities. Costs that aren't borne by the producer are pushed downstream to us
right.
As consumers, and that really they should bear the cost of production. We heavily subsidize agriculture, as you know, as taxpayers in the United States. Lots of subsidies are going to production agriculture. We, unfortunately, are seeing the downside of that by paying additional costs to treat our water here, and it's creating a public health risk in our view. But that was a major theme of our litigation and our public policy concern, and the idea that the sky is falling and poor farmers just can't bear up to the cost of having to clean up water before they push it into the waters of the United States just seems to us to be a pretty absurd view. It's a little bit like U.S. Steel or Exxon or whomever is a point source air polluter saying, gosh, we can't afford to clean up the air before we push it out of our factories. So it's certainly a theme that they've tried to articulate, not one that we buy into.
Absolutely not. And now tell me, so what is the local, like how in the wake of the federal court throwing your case out and then the attempted coup of, you know, dissolving the waterworks, what is the mayor of Des Moines saying about this? What is the municipality saying? Because after all, it's your consumers that are being polluted, right? So what kind of support are you getting?
The mayor here has been pretty ambiguous about what his position is. The city generally has been supportive of the coup d'etat, that is, of disbanding us.
Yeah.
And we think that's, you know, for political pressure, but also as a utility, we have a number of assets, income assets that the city would like to have to bolster their coffers. But at the end of the day, what we're hearing from our ratepayers, our residents, is very much in support of waterworks. We know that safe drinking water means separate rate structures and distance from the politics of municipal government. We're confident ultimately that our position is going to prevail, and we believe there are leaders in the Republican legislature that view our position as being the right one, that is supportive of home rule against the state interfering in local politics, and we think ultimately we're going to prevail.
Oh, I hope so. So how? What's your strategy? Like, how do you protect yourself against the bill that Jared Klein.
Maybe we should talk about that for just a second. I sit in the middle of the state in what for us is the urban suburban area, about 500,000 folks here in the area. Representative Klein is a member of the Iowa Pork Producers, the Iowa Farm Bureau,
of
and
course.
The Iowa Corn Growers Association. He's from us. Those aren't interesting credentials to deal with a city governance issue. I don't know what are. He sits about 100 miles away from us.
Right.
And initially, his excuse for doing this is that he wanted to provide an opportunity for greater regional discussions in this area of the state.
Right, now, he was talking about the suburbs,
been
right?
It's amended to get rid of all that, and it's just a hostile takeover, basically. But, very interesting get-even kind of philosophy going on there, at least in our view, and one that goes against the grain of good government, where independent water boards are pretty important to protect against political influences from electives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm still kind of just reeling from the idea that that your suit was dismissed from federal court, just like, boom.
Well, so am I, Katie.
Why did that happen? First of all, your date wasn't...
The side of all that is this. The governor of this state and the Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, as well as a number of leaders in the political system, have said that our lawsuit was a distraction and taking resources away from voluntary conservation practices and from cleaning up the environment. Well, with victory lies the responsibility, and to some degree now it's fully in their lap. They need to deliver on the promises that they've made for 4 years through the nutrient reduction strategy that essentially says voluntary conservation practices from agri-producers will lead to environmental protection and improvement in the environment. Well, now you can rest assured we'll be watching that very
closely.
Put
your money where your mouth is, folks. Because why is it suddenly affordable when, you know what I mean? Like, why is it now affordable if it's...
Great question.
Really?
It's just a matter of, I guess, the pace of which you're going to protect the environment, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll do it the next 100 years. We'll see.
Well, that brings me to another question, actually, let me see where that is. Oh, yes. I was struck by, when I was reading the newspaper coverage, by the following statement, quote, "Waterworks hoped to reverse nearly a century of legal precedent that's given the districts immunity from being sued for damages. That would be the districts up, the counties upriver.
Right.
The utility argues the protection relieves the drainage districts of responsibility to limit farm runoff into streams and rivers. So, in other words, it has not been those regulations or whatever the, you know, whatever you call those instruments that prevent farms from polluting. That hasn't been changed in 100 years, despite the fundamental changes in farming techniques. And
you've got a absolutely dead center.
Amazing.
This is a state that's very dominated by agricultural politics. 100 years plus ago, public improvement processes, projects upstream had public money put into drainage systems of farm fields that are now leading to more water and worse quality water coming into the streams and rivers. That's been around for a long time, and it was premised on the idea that you just move water away from farm fields because we're in an area of the country that has more water rather than less water most of the time, even with climate change. So getting water away from fields was the state's priority. Any kind of downstream impacts in terms of flooding or in terms of public health from poor water quality weren't contemplated by the legislature 100-plus years ago. So we certainly have tried to move the needle on that because the science has certainly caught up with the failings of those premises. But unfortunately, to date, our legal system and our public policy hasn't caught up to a realization that letting industrial ag do whatever they want with no consequences downstream is a failed policy that will just lead to catastrophe.
I mean, your ratepayers, I'm sure, have seen a great increase in their rates for getting clean water. You yourself have talked multiple times about the fact that you don't even have infrastructure that is capable of delivering without some difficulty, the delivering the clean water that you need. I mean, in other words, your infrastructure is old, and it's not built to strain out as much of the phosphorus and fertilizer and CAFO runoff and everything
else.
It's just not built to do that, and that you would need a massive injection of cash just to make it really to make the water safe in Des Moines. And I remember from my visit there a couple of years ago that that literally the water stank so badly in the city and coming out of the taps. I was just stunned by that. And then when I mentioned it to my hotel, you know, whatever it was, and they said, oh, nobody drinks the water out of the tap here. Like, you know, I mean, it was just, I couldn't believe it, because in New York, we totally pride ourselves on our wonderful quality drinking water, you know, and, you know, to me, to not be consider that an absolute fundamental right is sort of extraordinary. But there was one more thing I wanted to bring up about you, and then I'd like to talk sort of about a bigger picture in terms of infrastructure and water for other municipalities. Here was another quote from that Des Moines Register article. It was, quote, "It renews hope that the federal district judge will dismiss the case," which he has, "and Des Moines Water Works will abandon its expensive and divisive litigation," said Roland Schnell, president of the Iowa Soybean Association Board. It also renews our optimism that the utility will engage in a cooperative approach with rural Iowa to make real and long-lasting improvements. Now, isn't it true that before you brought this suit 2 years ago, that you made a serious attempt to engage in cooperative approach, and you were unable to persuade
them? Absolutely, Katie. We've been involved in cooperative approaches for decades with upstream producers. The reality is that that cooperation became almost co-optation. It was greenwash, and nothing was coming out of it in terms of results. We continue to see horrible water quality in the streams, rivers, and lakes in the state. And at some point, you know, we've just called the question on whether that kind of feel-good discussion is in the best interests of our customers.
Right.
We've been made out as the villain in this on a regular basis.
Well, this is exactly what I wanted to ask you.
We're big boys and big girls. We can handle that. The reality is that whether it's Gulf Coast hypoxia that we continue to see marching forward in a very destructive way, or whether it's water quality most locally here in our rivers that are part of the Mississippi River Valley, we're seeing industrial ag continue to get a free drop. It's the Wild West. Whatever they do and whatever they put in the rivers is acceptable, so long as we hide behind this screen of voluntary conservation and a sprinkling of good practice practices out there. We want to see results. We're going to continue to want to see results. And certainly the net result of all of these court rulings is that the people who are ultimately responsible for this are the producers. And if anyone is going to step forward to be able to deal with them, it has to be our state legislature. And those are not parties that have been willing to do anything other than hide behind cooperative and collaborative cliches. We'll now see if there's any substance there.
Well, I think we know what that's going to be like. But I got to ask you, Bill, I mean, are you like, why does the Des Moines Register report this as if you are the villain rather than the hero? I mean, this is your city paper. So why are you the bad guy here?
Well, the Register has, I think, been fairly balanced. We can't, we're not going to talk about so-called judges or fake news. You know, that we're in a democracy. We have to learn to lose and move forward. And that includes not attacking the media. The media, actually, the Register has been fairly balanced. They've written a number of different articles that have been positive towards us and towards our concerns here.
It's good to hear.
But the reality is that industrial ag continues to see any opposition to the unsustainable practices that they buy into as villainous and anti-agriculture and trying to, kill a food system that will end up in starvation.
Yeah.
we don't buy that, and we don't think that our consumers and voters in this state buy it. So we're confident that we're on the right side of history in this, but we're certainly taking some short-term lumps for it.
Yeah, you are. But let's talk a little bit about because Des Moines is not alone in this problem.
We're not.
For example, Toledo, which I've also reported on with my buddy Tom Philpott, for a couple of summers past now, they've had to tell people not to drink the water because of the agricultural effluent in Lake Erie. So they have a very similar problem. And I'm sure there are other towns and municipalities in Ohio, also another big ag heavy state, that are suffering from similar issues. So do you guys ever like get together to talk, what I'm looking for is whether or not
Absolutely.
There's sort of a coalition building thing going on in terms of people like yourself who are part of a municipality that is, duty bound to provide clean water for their residents. Like, are you guys talking to each other? What's happening?
There's no question that by necessity, a number of us who typically operate pretty independently don't have the resources nor the coordination at the national level that industrial ag does are by necessity.
Right.
Talking on a regular basis. I'm part of a Lake Erie study group, so I'm very familiar with what's going on in northern Ohio that is leading to the continued pollution of the Great Lakes generally. And this is an issue that by necessity is driving a number of us together. If that weren't enough, certainly concerned about national implications of the EPA falling back and their vigilance. So I think what will come out of that is a number of states and local water producers stepping up on a more regular basis and coordinating their efforts just out of necessity, because Toledo, as an example, as you know, lost their drinking water a few years ago because of cyanotoxins, blue-green algae. We'll see more of that, unfortunately, and out of necessity will come a greater coordinated view of how to push back against this. Ohio and the Ohio Farm Bureau have actually been very cooperative in working a number of restrictions on production that are better protecting the lake. You mentioned New York earlier in your pride. We still are in a state that's very dominated by industrial agricultural politics. We think we'll crack through that eventually, hopefully with a minimum amount of catastrophe. But the prospects in the short term are pretty bleak, obviously.
They do seem bleak. I mean, it really does, especially as let's talk for a second. Let's use this opportunity to talk about the EPA and Scott Pruitt. Your suit was predicated on sort of a factor of a facet of the Clean Water Act. Now we know the federal court has thrown your suit out, so that takes that question away. But I mean, because the Clean Water Act is likely to be rolled back significantly under this administration, I mean, what other ammunition? Legal ammunition do municipalities and organizations like yours have against big polluters? Like what you know, if clean water as a fundamental right does not sway legislators, like, I don't know what will. So I, you know, I'm looking for, you know, for you guys to figure out, like, when we don't have the EPA backing us up and we don't have the, you know, what are you guys going to use for ammo?
Well, great question. And we were seeing leadership in a number of different ways away from the EPA. You see Governor Brown and the California legislature, you know, really asserting themselves as an example. It's a pretty inefficient way of doing it. We're part of the Mississippi River Valley. And certainly when there are national and international issues going on, you would hope that central government would be more assertive. Mm-hmm. In the absence of that assertiveness, local communities are going to have to step forward. And that often, in my experience, comes out of crisis. We're going to have water issues, whether it's from cyanotoxins or blue-green algae, whatever it may be, or nutrients more generally, like nitrate concentrations in the Midwest. There'll be circumstances that are going to push that. But I am optimistic that as the science gets better and our understanding of public health consequences get better, voters, consumers will support and insist on initiatives to move forward that's going to better protect our environment. The environmental consequences continue to pop up, and I think our consumers and voters hopefully are being more informed by programs like this about the risks of the current unsustainable agricultural model.
Yes, I would hope so. But I mean,
you
that
and me
does
both.
Well, you know, because it does address that sort of fundamental divide between Republicans and Democrats, where Republicans think that, you know, the federal government should have nothing to say about what states do with state assets, including their water, right? So, I mean, it's you know, these are people who continue to vote in their own worst interests. And, you know, I find that very troubling in terms of, like, you know, trying to clean up these problems on a sort of national basis and allocating funds and resources on a national basis. But let's talk a little bit about the infrastructure of in the United States that carries water, because if it's whether
happy
it's
to do that.
Whether it's because you're an engineer. So whether it's, you know, whether it's effluent, you know, fertilizer, effluent from CAFOs, whatever, or whether it's lead in the pipes like Flint, you know, we have a crisis. In my opinion, we have an ongoing crisis in how we are going to continue to receive clean water in the next decade or so without committing an enormous amount of resources to upgrading our water infrastructure. So can you talk a little bit about that as an engineer? Like, what would be the best way to educate people that this is a problem? Like, I don't think people even freaking think about that.
Let me start with this premise. And the premise is you and I and all of your listeners are going to be paying more for drinking water as time goes on, because we're behind the curve in the United States as to infrastructure. And even the current administration understands that and appears to have an emphasis on infrastructure improvement. But whether you're in New York or you're in Iowa or you're in Ohio or California, we have aging systems in surface transportation, in underground systems like sewer and water and telecommunications, railroads, electrical systems, whatever it may be. We have shirked our responsibility as managers and as consumers to fund that. We're going to see that change, obviously, and that's going to be more costly for all of us as consumers. But I do believe that there is an increasing appreciation on behalf of consumers when you put a good case in front of them for rate increases, of acceptance to that, because I think most of us understand that an interstate system or an electrical system or underground pipes require investment. And we have often taken a short-term approach that says, oh, we're going to have small rate increases or no rate increases and defer maintenance. That deferred maintenance is kind of like, you know, not changing the oil in your car.
Right.
You can decide not to do that for a while, but sooner or later it'll catch up to you in a far more expensive way. And I think we're going to see more of that catching up, if you will, in infrastructure across the United States.
Well, I hope so. I hope you're right, because, I mean, my sense from the Trump administration, from what one has seen so far, when he talks about improving infrastructure, he's talking about awarding large contracts to his buddies in, you know, I don't know, the people who in the petrochemical industry. So that would be like, okay, roads, maybe roads, maybe, Maybe train tracks.
Oh, well, I don't, you or, know, but maybe walls between us and Mexico. Yeah. That's infrastructure,
yeah.
Right?
Let's, by all means, let's spend $23 billion on that.
In terms of supporting economic and social development, but it definitely has a different view of the world. I think local governments, again, and local authorities, whether they're sewer or water or telecommunications or electric utilities, as an example, will step forward out of necessity and out of good management and good planning. We can't talk about climate change, apparently, if we're federal employees with any rigor anymore. But as we get more data and more experience about flooding and droughts and cold and hot, it's going to require us to invest more in our infrastructure to protect all of us from things that we've been able to take advantage of, but without a lot of investment. But that curve is quickly coming to an end.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, because as we've just reviewed, the infrastructure for water, carrying water to and from cities, or even to in and out of rural counties, is at best 75 years old, right?
At best, far older.
And probably far older.
In most cities.
Yeah, I mean, I know that in New York we have three main tunnels that bring water to us, and two of them basically are 100 years plus old. And there's going to come a moment of reckoning here in the state of New York if we want to continue to, you know, enjoy the clean water that we do, where we're going to have to deal with that and pay for it. And I know that Cuomo is definitely kicking that can down the road. I've not heard one word about it, even though I hear that it's an issue. I don't hear that there's any bond proposal or anything that would raise the funds to get working on that. But I could be wrong, and I hope I am. Why do you think that things like water quality are so low on the consumer radar? You know what I mean? Like it's only when there's stories like yours or Flint or Toledo that people ever think about water, and yet water is so fundamental. And I just find it curious that there's no press around it, really. There's no, you know, like the public awareness campaign that we need to help you guys do your job is totally lacking. And I want to kind of close with like a discussion about how we can raise that awareness, because not only will we be facing these water shortages as climate change escalates, but we also have these obvious infrastructure problems and and all of the other related issues that we've been discussing. So what can we do? Like, how can we create a public campaign? What would be your best case scenario for raising consumer awareness so that you can potentially influence states to legislate for more infrastructural repair or solicit more money from the federal government for that?
You know, I think there are a couple prongs to that. One of them is, I think, activism and environmental and community organizing groups. We're seeing, I think, a greater attention by the media, whether it's water shortages or flooding in California, I guess, in the last several months, at least on the flooding side, but certainly did a great job, and most of the media, I think, of talking about water crisis issues in California or water crisis issues internationally. I think we're seeing more from the media along those lines, and so I commend that and think that environmental groups need to continue to take those kinds of initiatives to push that information out and to recognize things like climate change are not very debatable in the real world, obviously, and
right.
It's important to go against the political grain sometimes to be able to make that happen. And then I think second to that is we as managers in this area need to do a better job of explaining the risks and need for rate increases in our business to be able to support infrastructure changes. Because in my business, again, we've taken some pride in trying to minimize risks by kicking them down the road, as you would say, kicking the can down the road. People have to recognize, as consumers need to recognize, that there are going to be greater costs that need to be borne, and rate increases will be out there because of that. But it's obligatory, I think, on us as professional managers in water, wastewater, whatever it may be, environmentally related issues, to talk about that in a way that people can understand and appreciate and
own
and advocate. Exactly.
Yeah.
And own.
I mean, I think that we tend to live in a bubble of like, yeah, though, turn on the tap, the water's clean, yummy. for those of us who are not water challenged, I should say. But then I was struck, as I said before, in Des Moines, where the woman just shrugged at me and she said, well, of course we don't drink the tap water. You know, like, duh.
Yeah, like that's acceptable. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's just business as usual.
We've bought into some premises here that we're trying to turn around, and that is that industrial ag necessarily should lead to these kind of consequences. That's unacceptable.
I find it just fascinating that the farming community, but of course, we're not really talking about the farming community qua farming, like what we think of as farms, right? We're talking about large agribusinesses.
Absolutely. So, and when we talk about agriculture, you know, there are some extraordinarily responsible producers in the local foods movement, in the organic movement, in the CSA movement. Our concern are the people far away from that. That is the industrial ag producers. As you know, if you've ever been in this part of the Midwest, we're talking about thousands of acres, not family farms. This is not Norman Rockwell or Grant Wood's America that dominate the farming culture in this state. It's industrial ag with a few huge owners that are continuing to engage in practices with environmental and public health adversity.
And that's why when I brought up the fact that they said those fines would be crippling, you know, we're not talking about a mom and pop farm, a medium sized farm, you know, a guy who has maybe, I don't know, 500 acres or 1,000 acres.
No.
We're talking about somebody, yeah, right, with hundreds of thousands of acres under cultivation who is making plenty of money. So,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, I think it's important to make those distinctions also. I mean, I feel like, it's key to make it clear that there are farmers and there is agribusiness.
Absolutely.
And they are not
and
the same thing.
And realistically, family farming is very much endangered by agribusiness.
Absolutely.
As the scale gets larger, the operations become more industrialized. Smaller family farms are being pushed out in this and other states.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with that, I guess we should close. Bill, thank you so much for joining us and explaining what is happening in Des Moines. And I'm so sorry that federal suit got thrown out. I'm still kind of gobsmacked about that. I thought your date was in June and that you had plenty of time. Anyway.
So did we, Katie.
Yeah.
But it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate your time. Come back.
Media like you that are extraordinarily important in keeping the message moving forward that we have to be environmentally responsible.
Absolutely. I mean, I only wish that I had the reach of the New York Times, but you know, maybe in my future. Bill, thank you so much. And thank you so much to Bob's Red Mill for supporting my program. And thanks to my engineer, Dave. And we'll see you next week with another great show. Thanks for listening, people. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.